and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start off with an update from the Capital Region Transportation Council's planning process. Then we get a student's perspective on the recent campus protests about Gaza. Later on, for this week's Our Mayo on the Brink, they look at abortion bans. Then we have a live interview with Ellen Sinopoli, and she'll be joining us to talk about her dance company's May 18th performance at the Egg, the final one of the season. And then we finish with hearing about building community through dance with Barrio Alegria. But first, headlines.
The Times Union reports that the Comfortex window blind and shade manufacturer will be laying off its staff of 85 workers and closing its plant at 21 Elm Street in the Maplewood neighborhood of Colonnade by the end of the year as the company consolidates work in other locations.
Carlos Cotto Jr., the new Schenectady superintendent of schools, wants to boost test scores, graduation rates, and attendance. However, he intends to maintain a high visibility in the community, particularly in promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. He wants to provide more support and opportunities for struggling families.
Recently elected, Columbia County District Attorney Chris Liberti Cannot has established a process to review cases where defendants may have been wrongfully convicted. The DA said that such a unit is a best practice for modern prosecutor's office and would help reestablish trust in the criminal justice system.
The Time Union reports that a coalition of more than a dozen Schoharie County towns is suing the state, contending the mandated method for taxing solar and wind farms is unconstitutional as it usurps the authority of local assessors and shortchanges municipalities of needed property tax revenue. In an effort to encourage more solar and wind energy, state laws have limited the property taxes these facilities have to pay.
The Gazette reports that the second phase of a $13.8 million project upgrade Scotia municipal facilities has been delayed after bids for the project came back higher than anticipated. Village officials say they're weighing all options to finish the voter-approved upgrades.
The state has added 3,700 acres of forest land on the Rensselaer Plateau. The Cowie State Forest and the towns of Postenkill, Petersburg, and Sand Lake, which is obtained from the Cowie Forest Products, will allow for hiking, sustainable lumbering, hunting, and snowmobiling.
In Colonnade, residents must now use paper bags to dispose of yard waste. The town said that the past use of plastic bins was directly related to poor safety and costly workers' compensation claims. And in Troy, a gas leak on Wednesday afternoon forced the closure of a two-block section of River Street.
After 34 years, Karen DeWitt, the state capitol reporter for NPR, is retiring this June. That's it for headlines.
So our first segment this evening, the Capital Region Transportation Council has completed phase one of its Metropolitan Transportation Plan. Sandra Misiewicz, the executive director of the council, talks with Mark.
Today we are talking with Sandy Misiewicz, who is executive director of the Capital Region Transportation Council, and they recently completed phase one of its Metropolitan Transportation Plan, which is a plan that outlines budget priorities for a safe and connected future transportation system. So, Sandy, thank you for joining us. And maybe we'll start with a two-part question. You know, what is the sort of the general mission, purpose of the Capital Region Transportation Council? And what is phase one of your Metropolitan Transportation Plan?
Well, thank you for having me today. The Capital Region Transportation Council is a transportation planning organization that assigns federal transportation funds to regional and community transportation related plans and works with communities and New York State DOT to fund transportation projects in the Capital Region, particularly in the counties of Albany, Rensselaer, Saratoga, and Schenectady. Our Metropolitan Transportation Plan, which is going to be known as the In Motion Plan, is a long-term plan that will guide how we're going to invest in the transportation system and set regional transportation planning policy. The phase we just completed, phase one, is our data collection step, and that included information that fed into the development of a regional trend story map. A story map is a web-based map that contains text and data, and converts that content into an interactive experience to tell a story. So it's a great way to take what is traditionally very sort of bland information and transforms it into a format that we think is going to be much more compelling for folks to engage with and ultimately to respond to a survey.
Now, I was actually checking out earlier that interactive website. And so one of the points that was raised, we're not just talking about, you know, public transit or mass transit, we're talking about all forms of transportation here in the Capital District. Are there particular trends or challenges that the plan has identified?
Sure, yes. We look at all aspects of transportation, whether that's walking, biking, public transit use, driving, and we have identified some trends, one of which is we have an aging population, and as people get older, their driving needs may change, and how they get around may change. So that's an emerging trend. Safety and certainly crashes and eliminating fatalities and serious injuries is a common theme. We certainly are looking to expand our options in the region to make sure we have more opportunities to walk, bike, and use transit. So those are some of the things that are being highlighted in the story map.
So this is, you know, phase one of the transportation plan. So where do you go from here, and what is the opportunity for public input?
So we're currently starting phase two, which is our inform stage. And this is really our first opportunity to come to the public seeking input on what we've, the information we've gathered to date. We've created a short 15-minute video. It's called an Inform and Imagine Workshop. It's a short video that explains what the plan is, our approach to developing it, and how it provides the opportunity to explore big transportation ideas to help sort of shape the next generation transportation system in the region. And that video is followed by a very short survey, which seeks input on from the public on what problems they have with the region's transportation system, gives them the opportunity to tell us what they think we should be investing in, and also gives folks an opportunity to tell us when they've been to someplace else, whether it's here in New York State, around the country, or even around the world, that may have a good transportation system. Where are those places and what are those elements that they think they'd like to see here in the Capital Region? And all of this information is available on our website at www.inmotionplan.org. And the public's also welcome to send us written comments via our email address, which is info@capitalmpo.org.
So I live in a rural community. It used to be many decades ago on our town board. And one of my concerns, Rensselaer County, town of Posenkill, was the fact that we basically don't have any bus service. I think we had one bus a week type of situation. And then the other thing, for many years, I ran an anti-poverty organization, did a lot of things on welfare to work, and was also concerned about, you know, how do we redesign our transportation system to make it easier for low-income workers to be able to use mass transit, public transit to get to work, especially if they may work off hours. So, how is your plan in addressing sort of both the needs of rural areas and also of the lower income populations?
Sure. So we're actually partnering with our regional transit authority, the Capital District Transportation Authority, commonly known as CDTA, who is currently developing what is called a transit development plan. And a transit development plan provides the framework by which we invest in the future transit system. That includes a data analysis of where transportation needs are for transit riders, particularly the rural areas and low-income communities. And concepts identified in that transit development plan will be incorporated into our regional transportation plan, the in-motion plan. Some initial concepts that might apply certainly to rural areas is an expansion of what we call micro transit. Commonly here, it's called CDTA's Flex Transit on Demand, which provides sort of door-to-door service in areas that can't support a regular transit route with a schedule and specific stops. Often, microtransit is used in areas that have lower population densities, smaller populations generally, but it provides that flexibility, hence the why they termed it Flex Transit on Demand, to go where it's needed. In a geographic area that might provide access to folks that might not ordinarily gain access to it. And the TDP or the Transit Development Plan will also look extensively at our low-income, disadvantaged communities to ensure that the services being provided by the Transit Authority, that particular attention is being paid to those areas of the region.
You mentioned earlier that the Transportation Council has a role in helping to direct, federal transit funds. So sort of a two-part question. One is traditionally one of the complaints by some has been that the federal government is more putting money into, say, building and maintenance of railroad, highways for cars, and less the mass transit. So, where is the federal government these days and sort of that blend? And then a related question is, how does, climate change and need to reduce emissions and impact of things like extreme weather, how's that factoring into your planning process in the last 2 minutes?
So for the transit funding piece, we're very fortunate in our region in that we actually get two sources of funding at the council. One is from the Federal Highway Administration, as one is from the Federal Transit Administration. We actually flex some of our federal highway money over to CDTA to invest in transit, which is not typically done at MPOs around the country, but we feel that that is a very important component to ensuring that we're investing in public transit. And it kind of doubles down on that investment because CDTA is also able to implement what we call complete streets projects or infrastructure related to folks accessing the transit system. So maybe that might be a sidewalk, a bus shelter, a bike lane. So we're very fortunate that we've been able to make that happen. I think that we also have a regional policy and we're seeing it nationally that the last resort option is to build new capacity or build new highways. We're not doing that in the capital region. I think the tide is changing on that philosophy, particularly in areas like ours, where we have a more more modest population growth. In terms of climate, we are actively working on a number of initiatives related to the response to the climate crisis, one of which is, as you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions is a priority here in New York State. The transportation sector is a big contributor to that. So our plan is going to outline some strategies that seek to decrease the use of gas-powered single-occupant vehicles, increase transportation options by investing in transit, bicycling, and walking infrastructure, and hopefully expanding the infrastructure needed to support a zero-emission vehicle fleet.
I've been talking with Sandra Mizowitz of the Capital Region Transportation Council, and this has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. One thing I'll mention is that while New York has actually been able, like the rest of the country, to reduce the emissions coming from the production of electricity, we're seeing the continuing increases in buildings and in transportation. And one of the reasons why Governor Hochul continues to freak out about her cap and trade program is that she kind of now realizes that if we increase the price of using fossil fuels, then that means an increase in the price of using gasoline at the pump. And that is causing her a lot of angst. So we'll be curious to see how the issue of trying to reduce transportation emissions works out.
Next up, the recent occupation at Columbia University in New York City in support of a ceasefire in Gaza has spurred similar protests at campuses across the country. On Tuesday night, 300 students were forcibly arrested at Columbia and CUNY, as well as in other states. We hear from Anna, a student at UAlbany, about her perspective of this situation.
Over the last 6 months, there have been mounting protests across the United States related to the situation taking place in Gaza, where many of the critics of the vast number of civilians being killed, comparing it to genocide. In recent weeks, there's been an escalation of protests at various student college campuses across the country. Probably most noteworthy has been at Columbia University. And on April 3rd, 30th, for the second time, police were called in and pretty aggressively removed the police, removed the protesters from the college. So we're joined by one of the students at the University of Albany. Anna, as a college student, what is your perspective on the present situation?
I believe that the students have the right to protest because, like, especially the fact that a college campus is a public space, and I fully support what they're doing because they're not being violent with how they're doing it. It's very peaceful protest, kind of how we've seen, I guess more recently, the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of peaceful protesters that are just being kicked out of where they're protesting. I understand that you do have to have permits to assemble sometimes in those large amounts, but for the most part, it just seems like they're protesting peacefully and the colleges kind of want to shut it down.
Now, one of the arguments being advanced in some quarters, particularly by elected officials, starting with Governor Hochul, has been that the protests against the attacks in Gaza have bordered on anti-Semitism, and that many Jewish students in particular increasingly feel unsafe. You know, what is sort of your perspective on the issue of, you know, has this been a rise in anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I mean, I am not Jewish, so this is not like an inside perspective. I don't have, like, I cannot tell you how someone of that faith would feel at this moment. But from what I've seen on the outside, and even on my college campus, I have not seen any anti-Semitic, like, on the rise at my school. But I know in some schools, especially early on, there has been. But with some of the protests going on right now where the police are being brought in, I have not seen any big anti-Semitic chants or anything like that. But if that is like a big concern and, you know, maybe I'm just not seeing it, I'm only seeing like, you know, what's being put out. Like maybe there is stuff behind the scenes that do have that. I understand why that would be a big issue because like at the end of the day, no one wants anyone to be hurt during this. We're just protesting, you know, what's going on in Gaza.
Now, for many years, actually for decades, that, you know, Israel has been one of the, what they call a third rail in politics in the United States, and pretty much both major political parties are giving carte blanche support to whatever Israel wants to do. And, you know, older people in general, I think, you know, perhaps mistakenly, but they view Israel as partly sort of an atonement for the world turning a blind eye to the Holocaust and the genocide that took place against Jews, under Hitler and the Nazis, but younger people who, probably did not grow up with the Holocaust being such a strong memory, seems much more open to saying, well, it's not that we're anti-Israel, but they really are not properly treating people, primarily civilians in Palestine. So do you think there's a generational difference between students and older people, how they approach the whole Israel-Palestine conflict?
Yeah, I think there definitely is, because I feel a lot of people getting out. There are students. Yes, there's a lot of people protesting and a lot of people getting out there and being pro-Palestine and saying, fighting for that. But I don't see as much as the older generations. And I think that is because there's so much going on and there's so much money being put into Israel that they do turn the blind eye. I feel like, especially in America, you see that with the next election, because people won't vote for Biden or won't vote for Trump because of where they're going to put their money for Israel. And, there's younger politicians who are saying, free Gaza. So I think there is a big difference. Relating to the Holocaust, I see a lot of people who support the freedom of Gaza saying one genocide, we're not saying that wasn't a horrific thing. We're just saying that this is too. We're not putting that to the side. We understand how big of an catastrophe that was. And that is a horrible thing. And just because we're, saying free Gaza does not mean we're bringing that down in any way.
Now, one of my first jobs actually was the UF Campus Association director at that point was SUNY Albany, 40 years ago. But at that point, there was a very, significant number of Jewish students, on campus. What has been some of the reaction to, to Jewish students? I assume there's still a fair number of Jewish students on campus, to the situation, obviously, in the larger community, many of the protests have actually been involved with Jewish Voice for Peace. But what has been the split on the UAlbany campus?
I see on the UAlbany campus a lot of, with Passover coming up or just ended, I see a lot of things for, events going on related to Passover, or there's tables for Bible studies or stuff like that. But geared towards the Jewish community, occasionally I see there's a Jewish fraternity. There's Ask a Rabbi. So there is you do see a presence of religious views on campus, but I've never seen anything negative put on them. I know there was a bake sale that was kosher during Passover or before, maybe in a couple months ago. There is still a presence, but again, I'm not in the Jewish community, so maybe there is a bigger presence that I don't see, because I bet there is a club, because there's a bunch of clubs here on campus, and a lot of them, there's religious clubs. But I still see a presence of a Jewish community on campus. And I haven't seen anything negative towards them.
Yeah, so we have about 2 minutes left. I understand you're a, political science major. How do you think this present situation and the student protests and the pretty, some would say pretty violent, crackdown by at least some of, administrators and politicians on the right to student protests, how's that, sort of impacting, students moving forward? And at the same time, I know a lot of students have also been very upset, rightfully so, about the lack of action on climate. So, are students becoming more politically oriented these days in the last 90 seconds?
I definitely think that is true. Even on this campus, not just with what they're currently protesting, but I do see an increase of political events going on and just an increase of protests, no matter what the cause is on campus. And I think especially since 2020, there has been an increase in the younger generation getting very politically active.
So I do understand, I believe on April 3rd, maybe April 29th, there was some protest in support of Gaza at UAlbany. Any sense where the protests are headed, particularly with, you know, many college campuses about to adjourn for the summer in the last 45 seconds?
Yeah, I'm not sure on this campus where it's going to go. I bet there will be continued in New York City because there is such a large population there. In Albany, I'm not sure. I know there was protest at the Capitol as well as on campus, like in front of the Capitol building. And I hope they continue because I think they are getting the message across, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, thank you very much, Anna, for joining us today to talk about the student perspective on the protest. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk magazine. And so each Wednesday we do have a peace pocket. I will note that CNN reports that more than 1,500 people have been arrested on college campuses since April 18th. On Wednesday, the House, by a large bipartisan majority, passed a bill designed to crack down on anti-Semitism on college campuses, which they define as attacks on Jewish individuals, not all Semites, since Palestinians are also Semites. The 90 House members who voted against the bill included both liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans, who viewed it as an unwarranted attack on free speech. But for those just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content, find today's stories, and more at mediasanctuary.org.
In this week's Armeo on the Brink, Rosemary talks with Malina Dumont about how women can push back about increasing bans on abortion access in the country.
I'm Rosemary Armeo, the host of On the Brink. Here is a sample from this week's podcast, On the Brink of Gilead, featuring feminist Bard College administrator Malia Dumont speaking out about what angry women can do to push back against cruel lawmakers and judges making 19th century abortion bans work. The full podcast is available on YouTube, Apple, and all other podcast channels.
Okay, so why does this topic mean so much to you? And if I can get you to speak just without a question, without prompting, just tell me why you think this is important.
Yeah, it's about my autonomy over myself, basically. I believe that I own my own body, and I believe that I own every part of my body. And the way the abortion debate has been developing, it singles out one specific part of women's bodies, their uterus, as something that women do not have full control over. And I find that demeaning beyond description, and a form of institutionalized government condescension of an entire gender. So, I'm outraged by it. That's pretty much it.
So you're not surprised then by the reaction of outrage that we've seen from women across the country. And this is regardless of age, of state of motherhood or not, outrage from Republicans as well as Democratic women. That does not surprise you.
Right. No, it doesn't at all. I mean, I'm not a mother myself. I'm not planning to become a mother. I know like that motivates some people around this, but for me, like that's not what personally makes me the angriest. And I think the reason that so many people from different situations and walks of life are outraged is because it comes back to this basic idea of bodily autonomy.
Right.
And frankly, I don't understand people who are surprised by the outrage. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, maybe like, I just, if they would just stop and think for a second, like what it would be like to be in this position of suddenly having the government decide they should control an internal part of your own private mechanism.
Right. I get it. Do you think that Republicans are underestimating the outrage of women, voters?
I don't think so entirely. I mean, I think there's a little bit of wishful thinking in certain parts of the Republican Party, like that this won't rise, that they'll be able to focus on other issues like the border and immigration, because those are issues where they feel strongest. But I think one of the lessons from Arizona is that Republicans understand, and I think even Trump's state political director in Arizona has said, like, this right. is not a good issue for Republicans. And so whether or not they agree personally with the issue, they realize strategically it's not a good thing for them. And that even for independents have been shown to trust Biden more on this issue. So
it's interesting to me that the Republicans do have an awareness that, oh, they're going to look bad on this. So their method has been to, A, not talk about abortion at all, or B, to temper it with phony language like leave it up to the states, or we have to reach a consensus. I think that was Nikki Haley's. Surely we can come at some time that we all agree on. Is that a method you see working among women voters?
Not in a widespread way. I mean, some people may agree in principle with the idea, leave it up to the states. Like that sounds good in theory to a conservative. But then when leave it up to the states means you're going back to an 1800s law from Arizona, suddenly people right. realize, wait a minute. Even a lot of Republicans would say, well, it's fine. They're fixing it in Arizona. So it wasn't a problem to leave it up to the states because they're still able to fix it. So I don't think they're going to back away from that tactic. Also because it's been a really successful tactic for Republicans in pushing forward more stringent access to abortion on a state by state basis. Mm-hmm. So even though they realize that they're like in a large strategic sense, this is a losing issue for them, when they send it out to the states, there may be pockets of huge problems like Arizona, but by and large, it's working for them in a lot of other places.
Okay. Are we on a slippery slope, Malia? Do you see this, what we have done so far, dropping Roe v. Wade, enacting the draconian measures in some states, do you see that on the way to a national abortion ban or to further restrictions on, say, contraception?
I don't think that we're going to get to a place where there's a national abortion ban. Certainly there are a lot of people who are very vocal about wanting that. I just can't imagine that would happen. Also because it goes against the whole Republican strategy of leaving it up to the states. So I think they know, like there are certain people that for sort of optics reasons are going to continue to call for that. But I just don't see it getting much traction at all.
Okay, so not a threat.
But further restriction to contraceptions, possibly. But again, like I think that would happen on this, that already is happening on a state-by-state basis.
Sure. As we talk about, and the optic we talk about is parental rights in school, you're seeing the end. It's already been restricted, but you're seeing an end to sex education in many schools. Then there's restrictions coming or in place on contraception and no abortion. This is it's getting like Gilead. It's getting scary. One last question. You're an outraged woman. This is very much part of our politics right now. It'll play into the election. What can a woman do? What should pro-abortion women be doing?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't recommend what my initial impetus was. But I'll just share it with your listening audience. Everyone's heard of this effort, Take Back the Night, right? There have been marches for years women's rights activists marched to take back the night. And that's been an effort to sort of fight back against violence against women in general.
Right.
And when Roe was overturned, I felt like I needed to take back my body. It was a similar kind of thing. How can I take back my body from this government overreach? And I thought, well, the only way to do it literally is to get rid of the thing that the government wants, my uterus. So I talked to some doctors about, could I get a voluntary hysterectomy? Because I thought, like, if this is, it feels like a way they're trying to turn the uterus into some kind of dog chip, like a tracking device for women, you know? And I'm like, well, I don't want that. And so if that's the issue, then they can have my uterus. I just don't need it to be part of me. So I looked into that, and long story short, it's not really practical. No doctor is gonna just do this unless I don't know, I go to some really disreputable place, which I don't want to do. But that would, like, I was seriously, like, that was the level of outrage I felt and that was the like, that felt like the only real avenue open to me to make sure that the government cannot tell me what to do with my own body. Now, again, that's not really an option. I don't recommend it. That's not something that lots of women should do. But, you know, maybe we could come up with symbolic things, like, you know, I imagine getting this uterus. And of course, if I had it taken out, they're not going to give it to me, right? But I imagine putting it in a box with a big pink bow on the top and, like, you know, delivering it, you know, to Mitch McConnell's office or, you know, something really sort of dramatic, like, you know, here. But, you know, people could, you know, you can create a symbolic uterus and show up in mass and to hand them over. Like, this is the level of craziness that the government is driving consider.
It's not just crazy, it's cruel. I mean, I've been reading about women. We basically have criminalized miscarriage, which is a very common occurrence.
Yes.
It's now dangerous. Childbirth is dangerous now in this country.
So that was Rosemary Armeo on The Brink, and you can find the full broadcast on your favorite podcast channel.
And now in the studio, we're joined by Ellen Sinopoli to talk about the performance on May 18th at The Egg. Ellen Sinopoli Dance Company is in residence at The Egg for nearly, 30 years? So welcome, Ellen. Nice to have you join us. Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
We're actually in our 33rd season.
Oh, my goodness.
Resident company for 32.
Well, that's really something. That's a celebration. So you have four programs that you'll be
presenting? I have four dances.
Four dances,
that will be performed.
And correct. How did you, what are you performing for us?
It sort of evolved from some initial concepts, but we have two dances from the early 2000s, 2003, 2008, when we created them. And then I have another two dances, one that created that was from late 2023 and early 2024.
Okay.
So there's almost 20 years in between the first two dances we're doing and the second two dances, which I think is fun. I'm curious as to what the audience might see as far as what our choreographic approach is, that type of thing.
So why did you combine these four, the two earlier ones with the two?
Well, initially I was going to try to do it decade by decade.
Oh.
And that didn't seem to quite work out with the pieces that I ended up wanting to do. So the first two dances, one is entitled Falling, the other one is entitled Compás. And these are with two musicians with whom I've collaborated quite a bit, Maria Zementowski and Brian Melick. Maria plays classical Spanish guitar, and Brian is a percussionist.
Okay.
And I commissioned Maria to write the music for Falling, and then she and Brian both wrote the music for Compás. They are performing live, so that was part of it, that I felt like I couldn't ask them to come on the program and just do one dance. So there, we ended up deciding to do both. Plus, they will play a musical interlude in between those two dances. So that became one major aspect of the concert. And then I was commissioned to by the University of Albany and Capitol Trio to do a new work, which is entitled Boundary Behavior. And we first premiered it at UAlbany in January. That, at that time, was to live music. That was not possible this time. The artists are traveling in London, so they can't be here. But what I've worked with Willie Marlowe quite a bit. Willie Marlowe is a visual artist. And this dance, Boundary Behavior, is about what happens, the exploration of what happens when boundaries become malleable, when they alter the space, when they shatter, when they reform, and how does that affect the humans that are in the space as well. And I came across some paintings / collages that Willie had done. They're fairly small. They're entitled Kites. They are abstractly kites, but they have a three-dimensional component to them.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it in any other way, but since I was looking at boundaries that alter space, I felt that these were doing that as well. So I decided, and I got her permission, to take five of these paintings / collages, put them into one image, have them draped in space, and that's going to be projected, rear projected, for this dance. And then the last piece, Seance, we first did in December at the Opalka Gallery in Albany in response to an exhibit that was entitled Seance that looked at spiritualism that was very popular during the late 1900s, maybe early 20th century. A friend of mine, a colleague of mine, Hilary Tan, had passed away unexpectedly last spring, almost a year ago. I've collaborated with her in the past. We worked together at Union College. I really wanted to do something to honor her, so I found a piece of music, and I ended up using that for that concert. And it's called And the Snow Did Lie. Hillary is Welsh. She's from Wales. So there's that tie, and a lot of her pieces have a sense of that environment. But she also has very deep ties to Japan and the Japanese culture and Japanese music.
Wow.
And there's this mixing that occurs. So I wanted to honor her. So I was pleased with how the piece turned out in December. But bringing it from a gallery space onto a proscenium space, there were partial walls in the gallery. Well, they can't exist. So we're hanging fabric panels to represent that sense of, are they there? Are they not there? What is spiritual? What is human? They never disappear when they're behind them, but I'm trying to create this real and unusual environment of going back and forth.
Yeah.
So I've ended up creating a concert that I think honors four Capital Region artists.
I see. I was just going to ask you what the connecting tissue was between these four. So they're all Capital Region artists.
Right.
But you use art besides music.
Oh, absolutely. And
like paintings. You've always done that.
Right. Right.
And
sculptors and poets and architects when we did Spill Out. I mean, so yes, I've probably worked with more than 40 different kinds of people who create.
Isn't that great? Well, this is the end performance of the 23-24, right?
Correct, correct.
This is the final performance this year.
At the Egg. The one thing I do want to mention is that Andre Robles, who's been with the company for 15 years, this is his last Egg performance. He's retiring.
Is he the gentleman I saw in Barker Park?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm so sorry he's leaving.
He's been threatening to do it for a few years. He's finally doing it.
Will you be doing any Barker Park performances
this summer? We're working with the Troy Music Hall. Probably late August we'll be doing one.
Because that's for children, basically.
Yeah, right.
And it's in the little park right across from wherever.
The conservatory and from the music hall.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So what's on the format for 24-25? Do you have some exciting things to
actually
tell us?
There is one thing I'd like to quickly talk about.
Sure.
The Musicians of Mahwah.
We've
been back and forth for many years trying to collaborate and do something. So we are actually performing with them in late January, and I'll be creating two new works for that. They're contemporary composers. One performance will be at the Schenectady County Community College, and the other performance will be at Capitol Rep Theater.
Oh, brilliant.
So that's a big project for us. I'll be spending all of fall creating.
Oh, congratulations.
With my dancers.
That's great. I was going to ask you more about your dancers, but I think we'll have to do that next time because we're just about out of time. But just for a quickie, if anyone wants any further information, they should go to your website?
They can go to sinopolydances.org. They can also call the Egg box office or go to the Egg website, which is theegg.org, and look up under dance, and our information will also be there.
Well, Ellen, thanks for 33 years of bringing professional dance to Troy and the Capital Region. So that's May 18th, 24th at 8 p.m. at
Correct.
The
and there's a prelude talk earlier. Some of the artists will be talking to the audience.
That sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So that was Ellen Sinopoly from the dance company, Ellen Sinopoly Dance Company. You know what's coming up? Barrio Alegria is a community engagement organization that utilizes the arts, sticking with the arts here, to build, empower, and strengthen communities. Dolly speaks to Yuri about bringing together its Latin community by introducing them to folkloric dances style of her native Mexico.
Hi, this is Dalai. We are here in the Sanctuary Independence of Media. We are here with Barrio Alegria and with Judy, that is part of Barrio Alegria in the Grupo Guarani. And we want to do a little interview to her, like, about what is Grupo Guarani, meaning it's one of our big, proud of Barrio Alegria. And the first question for Judy will be, what mean Grupo Guarani?
Guarani significa bailar, y para mí Grupo Guaraní es traer el arte a la comunidad de Redding.
Guaraní means to dance, and to me Guaraní means to bring dance to Redding.
Why you create Grupo Guaraní?
Grupo Guaraní fue creado porque mi especialidad en México como profesionista es la danza folclórica, entonces tenía la necesidad de seguir ejerciendo mi profesión aquí en la ciudad de Redding, y ese fue el motivo por el que fue creado.
Grupo Guaraní was created because of my, in Mexico I used to be a dance teacher of folkloric dance, and I wanted to continue to exercise my profession here in Redding, Pennsylvania.
How Barrio Alegria helped you in the creation, development of Grupo Guaraní?
Barrio Alegria me ayudó, me ha ayudado mucho, ya que el Barrio Alegría nos permite ensayar, desenvolvernos como grupo dentro de la ciudad y fuera de esta.
Barrio Alegría permitted me a space for rehearsal of Grupo Guarani. It also helped Grupo Guarani develop both inside and outside of the city of Reading.
How will be or how is the impact of Grupo Guarani in your community?
Grupo Guarani ha tenido un gran impacto tanto en mi vida como Barrio Alegría, pero en la comunidad ha logrado compactar no nada más la comunidad mexicana, sino también está integrando a la comunidad latina que vive en la ciudad de Reading.
Grupo Guarani has had a great impact not just in my life and in Barrios, but also in our community. It was able to bring together the Mexican community, but also the rest of the Latin community in Reading.
How do you want keep developing, or how do you want make Grupo Guarani grow up in the future?
Grupo Guarani sigue creciendo y quiero que siga creciendo en todos los aspectos, ya que la mayoría de las niñas que están integradas en Grupo Guarani comenzaron a corta edad con Grupo Guarani y ahorita ya son unas adolescentes, el cual me siento muy contenta que ellas han podido crecer y van a seguir creciendo como unas líderes de la comunidad. Así las veo.
Grupo Guarani is going to continue to grow and has continued to grow in all aspects, especially with the young women and adolescents that are part of the team. I was able to see them grow from a really young age, and I'm happy to see them grow as leaders in our community.
How the girls and the mothers of Grupo Guarani and fathers in general too feeling about this new space that you creating for them?
Pienso que ellas se sienten muy contentas de ser parte de Grupo Guarani, ya que siempre están apoyando a sus hijos, hijas en los ensayos constantes, pero más que eso, siempre están dispuestas a buscar, a generar actividades para poder comprar los trajes que las niñas usan.
I think they're very happy to be part of Grupo Guarani. They are always supporting their children in rehearsals constantly and always looking for activities or ways to help finance the dresses that they wear for their performances.
We wanted to ask you something more representative. What is the feeling about to be representative of the community, the Mexican community, through Grupo Guarani?
Es una pregunta muy importante y me enorgullece ser parte de mi comunidad mexicana. Me siento muy satisfecha de poder representar a mi comunidad fuera de mi país, de poder transmitir a mi gente lo mucho que ellos han dejado al emigrar a Estados Unidos.
That's a very important question. It makes me proud to be part of the Mexican community and be able to represent my people through this work and to show how someone who immigrated to the United States can continue the traditions.
Okay, we want to dream a little bit more here. Which will be the next dream of the big dream of Grupo Guarani?
Uno de los sueños que me gustaría cumplir con Grupo Guarani es que ellos pudieran representar a nuestra comunidad mexicana en un espacio, no más importante, pero en un espacio gubernamental más reconocido, que realmente representaran a la comunidad latina latina de Reading, en, por ejemplo, en el Capitolio del Estado, o tal vez en la Casa Blanca, no sé.
One of my dreams that I hope to accomplish with Grupo Guarani is to have them represent the Mexican community in not so much a more important space, but more maybe a government space to represent the Latino community in from Reading, Pennsylvania, like in the state capitol or the White House.
What any details you wanted to share to us about Grupo Guarani and the work that you developed during these years with Barrio Alegría?
Que realmente Barrio Alegría y Grupo Guaraní han compactado de una manera increíble. Las niñas, las madres de Grupo Guaraní realmente sienten a Barrio Alegría como su segunda casa. Para mí es mi segunda casa. Entonces el poder compartir esa experiencia de Grupo Guaraní con la comunidad de Redín, o cuando nos invitan a otro espacio a bailar, veo la satisfacción de las mamás, de las niñas, el poder ser parte de Barrio Alegría.
Barrio Alegría and Grupo Guaraní are very connected. Barrio is like a second home to the girls and to their families. And we're able to share that experience, not just with the Reading community, but to other spaces that we go to present to, and it's wonderful to see the satisfaction in the faces of the young girls and their family when they're able to do that.
For final question, what do you want to send, what message you want to send and transmit to the Latin Americans that wants to create community?
Con Grupo Guaraní, lo que yo pretendo transmitir es que siempre debemos de estar unidos nosotros como latinos, que nunca dejemos de los sueños a un lado, que los latinos somos fuertes en Estados Unidos y que jamás debemos de avergonzarnos de nuestras raíces.
What I try to transmit through Grupo Guaraní is our need as a community to be connected with each other and to not leave our dreams to the side. Latinos are strong in the United States, and we shouldn't be ashamed of our roots and where we come from.
Awesome. With that, we end our interview segment. Thank you so much.
Barrio Alegría visited the sanctuary last year. During that time, they recorded these interviews. And we want to thank Stephanie Nica for editing, and we are sharing these stories with you now.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. We want to thank all the volunteers who made today's episode possible. This is a team effort. Volunteers include Zachary Grady, Rosemary Armeo, Andrea Cunliffe, and Stephanie Nica.
And not to forget Mark Dunley, please. And Mark Dunley. So we want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. And thanks to all of you, our listeners, for making all this worthwhile.